Well, I'm glad to be able to launch us off. I've been a long time, had a long time interest and passion in how do you build functional communities. I think we've got a great opportunity this morning to look at how we build functional communities with people with competing stakeholder interests. Our two panelists kind of represent a, I'll call it a top-down, a bottom-up approach. Paul McCrossin has been involved in retirement income design policies within Canada for 30 years. He was a member of parliament when Canada went through a major reformation of their retirement systems in the mid-80s, and was one of the key architects in helping design and implement that program. As since that time, he's been continued to be engaged in consulting and advising on emerging issues within the Canadian system. So he's just fresh from a unique opportunity he's had to work with a program in New Brunswick, and will be giving us that background. Paul is someone I've probably known for 20 years, and every time I meet with him, he has another amazing story or a little bit of anecdote where you realize his fingers have touched many, many items, so we're glad to have Paul with us. Rob is the bottoms-up guy. He's the guy who, you might say, gets to live in the real world that most of us feel like we live in, where we're kind of a player trying to make something better, but there's a lot of challenging situations and competing interests, and it's hard to see if in the end you're going to make much difference. But he's had, again, I think, success from kind of the bottoms-up approach about saying, how do we frame a question, how do we have an intelligent dialogue? So I think it's exciting that we've actually got two kind of case studies groups that have said, we're willing to step into the conversation. Let's see where we're doing. We're well-intended, trying to make a good effort to try and improve a challenging situation, and to see if the framework that, as a profession, we've been engaged in has some merit and we can have a more productive conversation. So with that, let's go ahead and get started with the panel.
Well, good morning, everyone. Over the last 3 years, pension reform has been an intensive in the Canadian province of New Brunswick. Shortly after election of the government in 2010, which almost coincided with a failure of two large pension plans, the government announced that it was going to create a commission to look at reviewing and revising all the pension governance and legislation, regulation in the province. So the three people appointed were a former provincial regulator, a lawyer, counsel, who, after leaving provincial regulation, basically become the go-to person for every corporate insolvency in Canada, and who was also involved in the restructuring of GM handling the Canadian pension obligations of GM. A professor of economics from the largest university in the province, specializing in regional economic development. Me, supernumerary just means part-time retired. It's a big word. But I'd been involved in basically every federal pension reform initiative for 20 years, from 1978 to 1998. And then the task force had working relationships every month. We met with a committee of senior public servants, basically the department heads in all the senior branches, and every quarter we met with a cabinet subcommittee. So the premier, finance minister, justice minister were plugged in all the way through. Well, what were the problems that we found? First of all, we found that almost all of the province's pension funds, both public and private, were underfunded. Many severely underfunded. The reported provincial deficits really understated the problem. Public service accounting is not market-based in Canada, and we needed to get realistic estimates. Canadian pension mortality had improved rapidly since 2000, and risk management was not prevalent in Canada. It wasn't required. So let me just switch over to the risk management. The IMF saw the Great Recession coming, the 2008 Great Recession coming in 2006, and it went around to the countries that could do stress testing and basically issued a warning that your system's going to run into real troubles because you're not using risk management techniques, which are now prevalent in Europe. So this is the warning they put out. I mentioned the mortality. I'll just explain this slide a little. That diagonal blue line, purple line you see, starts in 1935 and goes through the whole generation of the Depression babies. And their mortality's improved by 3.5% per year during their entire lifetime, compared to generations, cohorts before and after. And what we're getting in Canada, this is what's happening with the entire working male population of Canada. So what we're getting is that blue, or the purple triangle at the right-hand side, starts at age 60, and we've been getting 3.5% improvements year after year after year for all population in Canada over age 60. Well, I don't need to tell you, that eats the pension fund alive. And here's something else that we found. This is also from the CPP data. This looks at average mortality in red compared to mortality of those who earn who earn $47,500 or less, top line, over $50,000. So this is the income education effect. And what you can see is that people who are earning more than $50,000 are dying at roughly half the rate of people earning less than 47.5. There's a huge socioeconomic effect. So when we, in my mind, what was occurring in New Brunswick bore an uncanny resemblance to what was happening in Southern Europe with the Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and with about a one decade lag. So when we had the first meeting with the premier, we said, your province is going to fail 10 years out. What do you want to do? And his answer is, his question was, what's the right thing to do? He decided right from the first meeting, he wasn't going to try and kick the can down the road. He was going to address it while he had time. So the mandate, we had three objectives and two principles: stability, sustainability, affordability, and the principles of transparency, sharing all the data to everybody, intergenerational equity. And I went through the ages criterion, and it looks like everything that's been listed by the Academy in the ages maps onto our objectives and principles. So there's nothing that was missed, nothing much that was added. So the process. We started by reviewing the regulatory filings of all the pension plans in the province, all the big ones anyway. And the examination was helped, put that in quote, by a request from the province's oldest city, who basically said, we think pensions are going to take the city under, and we need relief. And they requested relief, we looked at it, and we decided they'd fail anyway, even if they got the relief. So the question is, what do we do from a public policy point of view? And we started looking for models that might work, and we focused in on the Dutch model, which is recognized as the best model in Europe. And we started modifying it for problems we saw with the Dutch model and problems the Dutch plans saw with themselves. So we had extensive interaction between senior retired people from the Dutch system, both on risk management and on concepts. But the problems in 2011 in New Brunswick were very different from the problems in 1997 in Holland. The Dutch had a healthy system, and they saw that maturing demographics was going to eat them alive. So the question is, how do they modify the defined benefit system to survive the demographic crunch? We had an unhealthy system with even faster rates of mortality improvement. So we had more stress. And what we came to see was that if we took the Dutch system and brought in a proxy for risk-based capital, so the Dutch treat their pension plans just like they treat their banks and insurers, they force stress testing, they force risk-based capital. And what we brought in is a system that has a proxy for risk-based capital. And the other change we made from the Dutch system, which they tested their solvency against government interest rates. And of course, in the Great Recession 2008, government interest rates were pushed down by the central banks. And what that meant is they were forced to value down at about 1.25%, which makes pension plans look particularly bad. We figured that a market consistent liability similar to that used in the International Accounting Standards, that is a AA corporate rate, was a better rate, and we looked around the world and saw that we thought it was reasonably market consistent. So the first case, we already had a target benefit plan of sorts for all in the hospital system in the province. So Canada has Medicare, all hospitals are part of a government cooperative, if you will. Government funds, the employer share, and the costs of the hospitals, but they're run independently by boards. And what we found is, or what had happened actually just before the task force was formed, is the trustees of the hospital system recognized that they were running out of money. Going concern funded rates had dropped to the 60% level, and annuity purchase solvency rates were down in the 40% range. So the courts, they sought advice from the courts, and the courts said, you got two choices. You can rapidly ramp up contributions, or you can rapidly cut future benefits. And cutting, the courts ordered that they had to consider cutting benefits even for people who haven't retired if they couldn't get the contributions up. So it was agreed that we would take this on as our first test case. We met the task force and the union leadership. They're all unionized sectors in the hospitals. And we told them where we thought they stood if we used up-to-date mortality, which hadn't been published, but which we had access to. And what they used if we calibrated to the market. And basically they were, I think it took their funded ratio down to the 20% level. And that was not the sort of news they wanted. And in fact, I heard later from the union leaders that the news we gave them was so bad that they considered walking out in the middle of the first morning. But the chair of the task force had been the advisor, the legal advisor to the hospital system before she accepted the task force appointment, and the union leaders had confidence in her. So she'd always been a labor side lawyer, and she figured if she was presenting this to them as part of the panel, and I was presenting it to them, maybe they better listen. So we started 5 months of weekly meetings, testing out alternatives to redesign the system, and at the end of 5 months, we had a sign-off, all the unions signed, a memorandum of agreement with the government, and we had a big photo op situation, and we launched the reform. So what's in the reform? First of all, we thought that all unindexed benefits, well, I mentioned there, the unions played a major role. We met with the union leadership, their council, their elected representatives weekly. We agreed quickly that we would focus in on the preserving past benefits as much as possible, but making COLA indexing conditional on past benefits. That future benefits had to be reduced so that they were sustainable with an affordable contribution. And generally that involved increasing the unreduced retirement age by 5 years, and in some cases in reducing the future benefit accrual as well. We brought in a contingent plan where conceivably benefits could be reduced, but if they ever were reduced, then restoring any reduced benefits became the first priority of the plan. Early retirement reduction factors had to be brought in line with actuarial factors, but could still have a modest subsidy. One of the things that you talked about was coverage. One of our insistences is that every pension plan that went into the new system had to cover all casual and part-time employees as all full-time employees. So we significantly increased the coverage in the province as well. And we agreed that the unions and the government would share all correspondence with the members, with each other before they were released, and that the unions would have primary responsibility for communicating with the members. And the final step is that we basically agreed that we'd go a target benefit route where contributions are essentially fixed with some small predetermined variability, and the fluctuations took place in the contingent benefits and the ancillary benefits. So this is actually a graph of the public service plan of New Brunswick. What we found was that if we set the contributions so that we had an expected open group funded ratio, and I'll talk about that, but basically that's looking at what funding ratio we look at 15 years out. And we found through trial and error, doing our stochastic testing, that aiming for a funded ratio at the end of 20 years of roughly 115% covered the volatility. And so the yellow bar there indicates of the 2,000 simulations, how many of them are in the 100 to 115% funded ratio. The dark blue indicates how many are in the 115 to 135. And the light blue indicates plans that have a bias towards being funded more than 135%. And if you're sitting up front or have really good eyes, you can see there's some red down at the bottom. These are the plans where the benefit reduction is triggered at any duration. And here's sort of looking at the worst 100 simulations, the worst 5% sample, where the failures apply. And we went through and analyzed these failures to see what was causing the plans to fail. And our worst scenario was an economic scenario generated in our system that basically mapped the Great Depression. And our second worst scenario was something that essentially mapped the Japanese 1989 to current recession. So we're getting realistic scenarios. And other than those two types of scenarios, which occurred very infrequently, whenever we had a reduction caused by something like a 1987 crash or whatever, the plan recovered. 85% of the plans that had a benefit reduction recovered very quickly, usually within 2 years. So, and this gives you an idea of what risk management's about. So this is the public service plan with the previous distribution of assets, which was tilted towards equity. And you see it has a very high upside. The expected funded ratio after 20 years was 140%. But we had funded ratios in our scenario that turned out to be less than 100%. And the idea of doing risk management is to pull up those bad scenarios. And the only way you pull them up is by reducing the exposure to high volatility, high performance investments. So you pull down the top line, you pull up the bottom line, but basically you give up nothing in expected yield. Well, that's the theory behind it. So having done that plan for the two plans for the hospitals, the first one we did was all professional workers in the hospitals, then all non-professional workers, then the two largest municipalities in the province, then the pipe fitters, which was a multi-employer plan covering all plumbers in the province, the members of the legislature, the elected representatives in the province decided if they were going to impose risk on their employees and on the private sector, they better take the same risks themselves. We then converted all public sector and crown corporations. Then the teacher's plan was converted about 2 weeks ago. It's in the process of doing show and tell right now in the province. And of course the legislation invited any private sector employer plan that wanted to convert to the new regime to switch. And the largest employer in the province has 6 pension plans and they're in the process of being converted. The largest grocery chain, brewery, candy manufacturer, you name it, we're getting big buy-in from the private sector who want the advantages. So this is all optional, nothing's coerced, but if you get the relief, you have to take on the restrictions. So we finally got some opposition last year. And interestingly enough, it was the government representing the highest paid professional employees, which includes the actuaries, engineers, whatnot, and the most senior retired public servants, who all had pensions in the six-figure range. And it was interesting that the opposition came, they all said, we have a deal. We had a deal when we were employed, and we don't want to take on any risk. Just pay us the money. But the unions who were covered all of the lower paid employees, they said, we can't risk losing our pension plan or whatever. We want the discipline in there. So the government mandated the change in the public service plan with the support of all the unions except for PPSI, the highest paid union government employees. We just decided we couldn't let them stop. And so we had, again, photo ops in the legislature with all the unions agreeing to reform the benefits. So the key political question. The question is, the public didn't know there was a crisis coming. The government saw there was a crisis coming. Can you take steps when you're elected to avert a crisis about which the public doesn't know? And the historical answer around the world seems to be it's very, very dangerous. People don't like pain. But in this case, we tried to involve all of the labor representatives. We have a four-year fixed election schedule, so the general election's coming up September, last week of September this year. And I can tell you that all the Canadian governments are looking at this, but everybody wants to see if the government of New Brunswick can survive. Because, you know, it's a simple, practical test for elected politicians. Can you do this and survive? Anyway, that's the what we've done in New Brunswick. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Rob Wiley with the South Dakota Retirement System. It's my pleasure to be here with you. In fact, it's my honor to be here with you. I spend a lot of time visiting with other members from public pension plans. And most of the time when we get together, it's the actuaries standing in front of us telling us how to make things work out. And so I'm feeling a little bit reversed in the role today of coming to you and telling you how South Dakota has approached our retirement issues. The system itself, SDRS, has been blessed to have long-term support from our actuaries. Don's friend of a long time ago, Paul Schrader, has been a great supporter for us and provided us great guidance. And we work with Buck Consultant right now, Dave Slezinski and Doug Fiddler. They provide a lot of what is the underlying ideas and process that can help us accomplish the things that we want to accomplish. So let me just jump right into it. And I have the slide. All right. Oops, this way. The mission of South Dakota Retirement System is to plan, implement, and administer income. Let me see if I can get this mic turned here. Income replacement programs, and to encourage additional savings for retirement, all of which offer SDRS members and their family the resources and the opportunity to achieve financial security at retirement, death and or disability, by providing an outstanding, appropriate, and equitable level of benefits. My plan is to take about 10 to 15 minutes with you today and just walk through some of the things that we've accomplished, some of the things that we would like to accomplish still with the South Dakota Retirement System. This is, as Dave mentioned, a little bit of a reverse role. Paul, in his almost revolutionary design and redesign of their plan for SDRS and for many plans in the states, it's more of an evolution. That is, we work from the bottom up. We try to improve things as we go, building on the successes of the past or trying to do better things with things that maybe haven't worked out as well. So That's the way we've approached the whole process of plan administration. South Dakota as a state is small in population compared to many other venues around the country. We are very fiscally conservative, and the state of South Dakota has virtually no debt whatsoever. SDRS was created in 1974. It was a consolidation of 11 small plans. Total membership is 77,000, and that is nearly every single public employee in the state of South Dakota. We are a consolidated plan, teachers, state employees, municipal, county, and any public entity that makes a resolution to participate has the opportunity to be included. So we do have great efficiencies in our own small little world. We have 23,000 annuitants and approximately payroll of $400 million a year. Seems maybe small in some venues, but for South Dakota, it is a very nice payment stream that goes to every county, every city, every township in the state of South Dakota, and so it gives us a great balance and spread our wealth throughout. Total assets are approximately $10 billion, and I've included two additional points at the bottom of this slide because they're fundamental in how we do business. One, we have a very fixed contribution rate. It is set in statute. It has never been changed in the 40 years that SDRS has been in existence, except for one time it was changed because we felt the general employees were not adequately, did not build an adequate benefit. So our change from 2002 from 5% to 6% matching employer and employee contributions since 1974 was the only change in contributions that we have ever experienced. Along with that, interestingly enough, in statute, we have set that we must maintain certain funding thresholds or benefits must be reduced, contributions must be increased, or actuarial assumptions and methodologies must be changed to bring us back within those thresholds. Interestingly enough, that lower end that requires attention on our part is an 80% market value funded ratio. So we primarily function by U.S. standards at very high funded ratios. Our board, and at the top of each page, I've tried to give you a little note of how the key principles of AGES fit in here. Our board is primarily elected from the members and also from the employers, and the governor has two appointees. It is a nonpartisan board. And it turns out, as interesting as it may be, we focus greatly on the fiduciary responsibilities of every board member, board of trustee member. And first is the system, second is who you represent. Now, obviously, that is our effort on the part of staff and our broad picture. Sometimes it leaks a little bit, but in general, we want the plan itself to be the first and foremost interest of every single member involved. The trustees are a management board. They initiate all of the legislation. They are charged with maintaining the actuarial soundness. If benefit reductions are needed, they are the ones who initiate that. And really, they are the experts in the field. On the next slide, I'll talk more about our relationship with the legislature, but though they are the management board, we do still have to go to the legislature for changes. State codified law functions as our plan document. There is a separation in South Dakota of the investment function from the retirement administration function. The two boards are sisters, but in the same time, each have different representation, have different responsibilities and reporting roles. I sit on the investment council. The state investment officer sits on the retirement board. We have a nice balance by each of us representing on the other, but at the same time, it gives us the independence that the investment people function solely for investment purposes and the retirement people solely for retirement purposes. It, both in SDRS and also at the investment council, we measure performance, we measure administrative and investment functions regularly against benchmarks and also against our peers. One of our more interesting attributes is that we have an incredibly good relationship with our legislature. My predecessor retired early based on not necessarily getting along with the legislature so well. And so when I came on board, I made it a different model to almost over-engage the legislators and the governor's office in what happens with SDRS and what's going on. We've built standing committees in the House and the Senate, in the local legislature, in the state legislature. They are our experts when it comes to the caucuses and the work in the retirement area in the legislature. As it has evolved, we bring all of our legislation and they go directly to the standing committees. The one thing that has happened that's a little bit unusual and it's really been good for us is that if a legislation comes to the Retirement Laws Committee from outside of the process of SDRS, typically the Retirement Laws Committee in essence table the bill and send it back to us so that they get the recommendation of the Retirement Board before they will consider a change to the retirement system. It's made for an amazingly interactive relationship with them. We have great support in the legislature. There is a bit of a story behind that, of course, in a small state like South Dakota. And you saw up there that there was only 800,000 citizens. Well, of course, only a little less than 500,000 are active workers, and there's 77,000 members of SDRS. 30 to 40 members of the legislature either are members of SDRS or their spouses. So we have a very natural, strong lobby in the legislature because just of the way the citizenry works. We have a great relationship with the executive branch too. They have two appointments on the board. SDRS is an independent entity, but again, it's a very engaged relationship between our different groups in state government. As I mentioned earlier, as it relates to efficiency and sustainability, our fixed contributions have been just that. We've worked with this within our own framework of 5 and 5 and 6 and 6 for virtually the whole time of the 40 years that SDRS has been in existence. It has forced us to build reserves, build cushions, and be very conservative in how we handle benefit structures. I'll show you that in a minute. It's built, in essence, we've built a funding policy based on that idea that targets 100% funding, that builds those cushions and reserves so that we can stand unfavorable situations and, if possible, improve benefits. We've set funding standards defining the conditions for considering benefit improvements at you must be over 120% funded before we'll even consider doing benefit improvements. All of the stakeholders in the system understand that and know, and they don't even approach the subject unless they know that we are in that funding range. So it makes life easier in that our legislators, our governor, everyone involved knows that unless you are well funded, that you're just not going to be able to get a change made. Likewise, we also have set the fourth bullet there is that if we go below that 80% funded range, we have to come back to the legislature and provide corrective action. And we have taken the position that corrective action needs to come in the form of benefit reductions. Fiscally conservative designs and practices with outstanding investment performance have produced historically high rates, market value funded ratio over 100% in 24 of the last 28 years. Here's that funding policy with all about our governance and sustainability. I've just touched on the items earlier, just that is the document that my board lives with, and I am sorry the print is so small that none of you can actually read it. It really, as I say, it's just funding objectives, setting up a cushion in reserves for protecting the system in downtimes, providing a high threshold for improving benefits, and providing a high threshold for when you need to adjust benefits. Let me move on to our design alignment and sustainability. Hybrid plan designed to include features that both define benefits and define contributions. I'll give you more on that in just a second. And we really focus not just on SDRS, but the impact of Social Security. Virtually everyone in South Dakota in public employment is in Social Security. But we have also moved in the last 5 years, or a little bit more than that now, to having a personal savings expectation in our mission and in our process, that we focus on this is not enough to be just a member of SDRS and be a member of Social Security. You have a responsibility individually for personal savings towards retirement, and we try and educate our members on that constantly and offer ways that they can do that. We have, in addition, a couple of portability features that are a little bit unusual. We balance what is the payment of a refund, a lump sum payout for those that are pre-retirement, the opportunity to take both the employee and the employer share and interest on both. Now, we balance that with offering a indexed deferred benefit for individuals who are vested that, in essence, improves their benefit once they terminate by the COLA factor that retirees get also. What that does is gives us a balance in that you have an opportunity to take out your funds, but at the same time you give up a large value in that you do not take your funds. It's been a very interesting flow for us, and we can talk about that later. The fact is that our board of trustees has worked a lot on the issue of short-term employees and maintaining the value of benefits because of the concern over leakages and the inefficiencies that happen because of those leakages. That was what prompted this change to the indexing of the deferred benefit. Our actuarial methodology is a little different than what you might see in some other places. Due to the fixed contribution rates and the requirements to maintain those rates, SDRS has used a frozen, unfunded actuarial accrued liability method since 96 and an asset-based valuation method with a corridor to match those assumptions. The frozen unfunded liability is reinitialized every time we do an experience study. The last study was in 2012. In 2013, we took an unusual step for us, an unprecedented step for us, and paid off that frozen unfunded liability. And effectively, what that does is the actuarial accrued liability as of 13, even under this frozen design, since it's paid off, is now equal to the entry age accrual liability. A portion of the statutory contributions, which had been allocated to pay the frozen unfunded liability, is now available to build on the cushion and mitigate risk. This reallocation is estimated to raise the likelihood of maintaining the SDRS funded status by 3 to 4% and provide a resource to amortize unfunded liabilities of approximately 5 to 6%. It's a real change for us. It is a new model, if you will, for us, and we'll see how it all turns out. We've done a lot of work to try and work to establish this and really see it as a mitigation of risk. That is, effectively, we're contributing 20% higher than our normal. Did I jump over that? Oh, here we go. Contributing 20% above our normal costs. Future benefit improvement methodology provides for full funding of any benefit improvement when funding policy objectives are met. That is, if we want to do a benefit improvement, and I mentioned to you reserves and cushions earlier, we have to fully fund upfront every change that we would make to improve benefits. We have to have, if we're doing $200 million in benefit improvement, we have to have inside the reserves, inside the cushions, that much money to allocate. No expectation of future payment to pay off any improvement. It has to be money in the bank. The Board of Trustees recently established that objective of 20% of annual contributions to mitigate risk. That's that amount above and beyond normal cost. SDRS cushion reflects the favorable investment results and equals access I'm getting around the corner here, sorry.
Excess.
Excess of market value of assets over actuarial value of assets. All of this, again, to mitigate risk in the part of the plan. Our COLA is based on CPI and funded status of the plan. We do not, we improve each retired benefit by the amount of the COLA every year. It could be, if we're fully funded, if we're at 100% funding, we'll improve it at 3.1. If we're below 80%, it's 2.1. And if we're in between those two funded ratios, it'll be based on the CPI. In South Dakota's situation, 25% of the normal costs are in COLA. So adjustments like this have a dramatic impact on how our funding is set up. Lowering the COLA immediately impacts the actual actuarial value or benefit value. We base most of our decisions on market value, identify and propose corrections in inequities. We are always looking at what's going on and if our activities are working the way we anticipate them to. A couple items, and are you giving me the hook here anytime?
No,
partner?
No, we're good.
Okay. Board policies and practices. This is about alignment and efficiencies. With creating the member savings goal above and beyond what is the SDRS goal and the expectations of Social Security, we're trying to meet the total income replacement needs at retirement, considering all of those. We've set up a special pay plan that permits transfers of termination pay to a tax-efficient retirement savings account. For individuals, it is an opportunity to build some wealth and also build towards that personal savings option. These are the termination pay plans that you see in some different places. We've also set up a 457 plan that has grown very nicely, and of course, we spend a lot of time on education and information about that plan for our members. We implemented automatic enrollment in 2010. It is very dramatic, the impact. Retirement Made Simple, Dr. Robert Clark did a small study on that some time ago, or a few years ago, I guess it is all it is. Amazing as it may seem, 90+% of those that auto-enroll stay in the plan after their auto-enrollment periods have left. It is a great success. The flip side of the story that I have to tell you about is that the employers have the option of being in auto enrollment. They don't have to be. We solicited hard to get them to participate. Many did not. Interestingly enough, the new hires in the employers that did not participate in the auto enrollment have less than a 5% enrollment rate for their new hires, as opposed to the auto enrollees at over 90%. If there is a message in there for all of us, and we're working right now in ways that we can additionally get more employers to participate, seeing exactly how significant that has been. We haven't had a lot of auto enrollment provisions in public plans around the U.S. yet for a variety of reasons. It's fairly new provision, but it looks like it could be a great success for anyone who's able to implement it. The unfortunate thing we did is we implemented it right close after the market recession, and so money was really thin. Balances had been cut for lots of people, and many were actually a little bit afraid of the market, and so we're trying to build those back right now. We also provide a unique opportunity to convert tax-deferred savings into supplemental pension benefits. That is, SDRS will, in essence, allow you, separate from the purchase process, to come in and, in essence, buy an annuity that mirrors the SDRS annuity based on balances you have in your 457 or your termination plan, and allow those to be transferred in and buy that up. Until we move further along in the growing of those 457 assets. We haven't seen a lot of growth there yet, but we see in the long run that to be an ideal addition to the plan. Let me conclude. We feel like things have gone very well for us. There are certainly lots of questions, and some things haven't gone so well, but many have. We are sound and meet the funding goals as we have established. We have conservative actuarial assumptions, but we're also, and as Paul mentioned, in Canada and New Brunswick, we have very great concerns about the mortality improvements that are happening right now. A teacher in South Dakota, and that's the biggest group in ours, is typically female and has and will live for a long time. The scales on the national level in South Dakota, we beat those, and you see that in many of the upper Midwest states, is that we live for a long time. And so we are real concerned about that and doing some adjustments on the mortality tables right now. That, of course, has an impact on sustainability. Those long lives receive benefits for a long time. So beyond that, we think our benefit practices are pretty good, though our benefit formula, particularly for our general employees, is lower than the average around, but it fits with what we see as the adequacy and income replacement needs that are out there, though we do have some work yet to do on that. Our early retirement incentives are probably too good. We're running into some workforce issues right now because so many baby boomers are out there and employers are losing a lot of people, and we're providing encouragement in the form of early retirement incentives. So I think we're going to find that some of those things may change for some of our plans just because it's almost a little bit contrary to what we need in our own workforces. And that may be more of a new hires type issue, but sometimes you have some of those things that seem to work out for a long time, but at some point in time may go out of balance a little bit. Our member costs and employer costs are below average. We continue to be driven by the fixed statutory employer and member contributions, and that does meet our actuarial requirements and gives us a slight margin, but at the same time, we remain concerned about the ability to maintain our benefit. And if I didn't say it before, we were in the group of plans that got sued over taking corrective actions back in 2010. We did, in our first time in 40 years, took a corrective action to lower the COLA and a couple, three other features of the plan. Got sued and immediately won in court in South Dakota. The provisions in our law, as I mentioned earlier, provide that we need to take a corrective action if they fall below those thresholds. It did. We took the action and the court supported it. I have taken more time than I thought I was going to, Dave, but I appreciate your going through this with me, and I look forward to questions.
Well, thanks to conservative actuarial assumptions, we had a cushion built into our timing this morning, so we still have a good 20, 25 minutes for Q&A. Just to help you feel a little bit better, Rob, I was told last night that out of all the people that had signed up, only 20% are actually actuaries. So this is, I think, an exciting opportunity for us. I think the heart of the actuarial professional responsibility is making transparent what is often seen as a black box, or making transparent numbers that are often used in a one-sided political conversation. So I look forward to your questions for this group. You know, we are at an intriguing threshold here. It's almost spring in the season of pension funding. There actually are possibilities that are real. I've been involved in this conversation for probably the last 8 years or so, and what 8 years ago were, oh, wouldn't it be nice if someone could do X or do this? We see now today already many of these items are things that 6 years ago I thought, well, those are nice, but they just won't happen because we live in a political world and no action is taken. So I invite your challenging questions, your hard questions, so that we can make sure that we are able to build on what we see here. So questions. Behind you there, Dave. Did you
Please identify yourself. Thank you.
My name is Henry Eichelberg, and I'd like to ask Mr. McCrossin, was the changes in Canada, did that just go through provincial legislation, or did it also require action at the federal level as well?
It didn't require any federal action. In Canada, under the Constitution, pensions are a provincial jurisdiction matter, and the feds just govern certain key sectors in the Constitution, interprovincial transport, banking, and energy in particular. But the feds govern the Income Tax Act. So there's a coordinating committee of provinces and federal government representatives who try to put the plan in effect so that it covers off both the income tax implications and the benefit implications. So generally, provinces regulate minimum standards for ensuring that benefits are delivered, and the feds regulate maximum contributions under the Income Tax Act. So what I didn't mention is last Thursday, the federal government announced that it was bringing in the shared risk plan for all plans in the federal jurisdiction. So they're the second government to move to adopt this model we developed.
Hi, I also have a question for Paul. I wonder if you could talk a little bit, maybe a little bit more detail, maybe about the test case you were talking about. I guess what I didn't quite get was how you move from a plan with a sound like very low funding ratios to one that was, put it onto a path to sustainability. What were the changes that actually had to be made to really fill in what sounds like a very big gap between?
Okay, so we took all accrued benefits and we basically converted preserving those accrued benefits, except that all accrued benefits had a COLA indexing in them of some sort or other. And the automatic COLA was removed and conditional COLA came in the future. And that conditional COLA applies to future benefits, deferred vested benefits, and to accrued benefits of actives and retireds. So that, and then for future benefits, we looked at the improvement in mortality and we decided that we had to increase the retirement age by 5 years, the unreduced retirement age, but everybody kept their old benefits with the old retirement age and the old early retirement adjustments, and the new ones were phased in for future service. So practically speaking, to keep the same retirement benefit, people had to work an extra month a year in the future, keep deferring their retirement by a month a year to retain the benefit they would have got under the old system.
Yes, I'm Lee Snell with the National Council on Teacher Retirement. I realize that benefit adequacy is a pretty tough nut to crack, but it seems to me that you can't talk realistically about costs or sustainability unless you do take that issue on. Frankly, I was a little disappointed to hear that the Academy had essentially ducked it. But I'd like to ask Paul and Rob, how did you measure benefit adequacy? I know, Rob, you talked a little bit about a holistic approach to that, but I'd like a little bit of detail about how you measure benefit adequacy and what you actually did come up with as what you worked from in terms of that ultimate adequate benefit that's so key.
Okay, so in Canada, there's a legal maximum pension benefit you can earn, or a member can earn any year, and that's a 2% of final average benefit, okay, on the first $130,000 of income, roughly. So that's the maximum benefit by law. If your pension plan provides less than that, then there's a formula that basically says every bit less that your employer provides creates tax room for you to set up a defined contribution side fund, basically, so that everyone in the country is targeted at a 2% benefit level combined contribution, pension plan benefit and personal contributions, tax-assisted contributions. So that's now in the teacher's benefit and the public service benefit in New Brunswick before and after were 2% plans. So that's designed to provide a 70% benefit replacement ratio over 35 years. And the municipality used to have a 2% basis, and when we looked at what was required to avoid having the municipality go bankrupt, that benefit was reduced to 1.8% per year, payable from age 65 versus the old benefit of 2% payable from age 60. So that's what was required. All the unions bought into it. They understood that it was, in the end, it was a question of jobs versus benefits. And the implications of going through, if I can say, a Detroit-type situation, because the liabilities were not dissimilar. The unfunded pension liability was roughly three times the total tax revenue of the city, total annual tax revenue. So we just laid it out. Either your city's heading for bankruptcy and you take your chances with the bankruptcy process, or we get a sustainable system. And the unions all elected, police, fire, you know, clerical workers, whatever, they all elected to get into a system that was sustainable.
Do you think that 70%
is an adequate? Yeah, I can tell you my own pension is far less than 70%, and I'm not having any problems at all, but I was earning somewhat over the $130,000 before I retired 8 years ago. We also have in Canada something called a guaranteed income supplement. So anybody who doesn't have sufficient retirement income gets a state-sponsored supplement. That's just part of the national Social Security safety net.
Lee, for us, we've approached it, again, from that very fiscally conservative basis. When we look at it and we review the income replacement designs with every experience study we do, every 3, 4, 5 years, when we look at it, and again, it goes back to the idea of what's appropriate and adequate, and we build on an idea that we expect our members to work a full career. In our case, we consider it 30 years instead of 35. And we expect SDRS to be in the range of replacing approximately 50% of pay, and then combining with Social Security to get most of our members, low pay state, range in the 35% replacement range from Social Security. State is less concerned about those that make a little bit more money and the ability, where they have the ability to maybe save a little bit better. We focus on the 85% income replacement. Again, we recognize that there's a certain amount of, you get what you pay for, and the idea of too high of benefits is really sensitive in my entity. That is, they're not, you know, the ability to come back and say I'm making more than I in retirement than I did in as I worked is a very critical option for us. Our benefit structure is lower than many plans. Our effective formula is approximately 1.6%. And so, you know, it turns out that we're actually looking at the 50% or just a little below that from us, unless you work extra time. And we've used a number of studies from around the country from different firms to pick up where the looks like the income replacement needs are. And as I say, we've spent a lot of time on adequacy, not just building on what's adequate for a retiree or a near retiree today, but what will be adequate for a young person today and how that will grow with them over time. So that's the process we use.
Hi, yes, Steve Goss from U.S. Social Security. Great presentations, but a couple of questions, particularly for Rob. First of all, Rob, remarkable success story. I mean, I wish all our plans in the states and in the North country were like that.
Thank
I
you.
Mean, just looking at your stuff, you say you, $10 billion in asset reserves and $400 million annual payout, about a 25-to-1 ratio, which was what fully advanced funded
I'm giving you a,
kind of
a,
looks like.
Not, that is not the net. That I'm not showing you $250 million in contributions separate from that payout. So the net payout is really more like, is less than $200 million, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow. So you have a remarkably high funding ratio then. Wow, that's really impressive. I'm glad that you talked about the benefit adequacy. I was looking at your numbers. If you had $400 million of gross payouts, something like that, and about 23,000 beneficiaries, something like that, that's something like about 17,000 per year.
You're exactly right.
Okay, now does that have a lump sum effect on that? Is that boosted up by some of the people who are in there just for 1 year because they're getting a lump sum, or if you put that into sort of an
annuity? Those are all lifetime benefits, and I have not included anything in there for what would be those terminated members that might take a refund. And inside that number are both those that have worked to retirement or have worked to an earlier age and then had their benefit, they're indexed until they start their benefit. So it, unfortunately, it's hard to bring it in, hard to state a single number sometimes in those situations when there's too much going on for a 15-minute presentation sometimes.
Great. Well, let me just ask three other little quick questions. First of all, is I think you said that the lever point here, if you are underfunded, is that you will diminish the COLA. And that's something that's been discussed at a national level. And of course, some people have felt that diminishing a COLA is maybe not the first choice because that affects people at the very highest ages when they don't have a lot of options mm-hmm. to go back to work.
Yes.
So diminishing COLAs as opposed to finding another way, perhaps mainly more affecting people becoming newly eligible, is one question. Second question is, how do you invest your assets and what is your rate of return assumption?
Sure.
And the third question is, could you just review again what your tax rates are? Your folks are all under Social Security, so they and their employer are paying 12.4% up to our taxable maximum. And was it another 10% they're paying on top of that, which would probably help us understand why you're having a relatively good funding ratio.
Sure. You may have to help me with question two and three, but as we work through this process, is it's six and six for the general population. We do have public safety included in the plan, so there's a little higher rates for those folks, but that is the extent of the contributions that are paid, period. That covers the normal cost and the expenses, and at this point in time, that additional cushion factor that our normal costs are just over 10%. As far as the tax rate is concerned in South Dakota, we do not have an income tax rate, and we do not have income tax in South Dakota, just all based on sales tax and other revenues. And so the tax factor is a little bit different. We're one of those states that sometimes gets considered to be a haven for retirees in that the income is not taxable in a case like that. And I have forgotten your first question. My short-term
asset
memory
yield,
is.
The asset yield rate? What was the asset yield rate?
Was there a pushback on the COLA idea?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Was there pushback on the COLA?
Oh, yes. Again, a short presentation, and the primary one was the COLA issue. There were four other changes that were made at the same time. Everything was designed to impact everyone involved. Changes in how we did the payout, changes in how we credited interest, changes in who was eligible for certain benefits, and the COLA. So it was a whole package of changes. The COLA was chosen because it was a permanent change, and that permanent change will have an impact on every single member of the plan, and that was the primary corrective action, what the board deemed to be the right answer on that day. If we had another circumstance that it came back up again that we needed to take corrective action, they may or may not choose to initiate that same design, but they, but at that time, that was the one that they thought was the best. So crystal ball would say I think that would probably be the way they would approach it again. but I don't know. Investments, as I mentioned, is a separate organization that handles our investments. We have a very sophisticated shop. They've been extremely successful over the years. We have a assumed rate of return of 7.25, but we also use a select and ultimate design. Current 7.25, and then after 5 years here, we're switching back to 7.5. We'll have an experience study before that time. It wouldn't surprise me if we approach that to constrain that potentially slightly more. That'll be something a couple years off from that right now. We had a great year last year. We had a 19% return on the fiscal last year. Having another good year this year, we're 103% as funded on a market basis as of June 30th of 13. We're up really, we're having one of those knock on wood kind of years, and so I'm hoping to maintain for a couple more months here, and we'll improve that even more. So it has been a good run.
So just a quick note to interject, our board of trustees for the day has made the suggestion that we use part of our dividend to make sure that we break 10 minutes earlier for lunch. we can do that. If there's a burning question you want to ask now, let's do it. But these guys will be around the rest of the day, and Paul's on several panels as we go through the principles. Some of those questions are easily suitable for that as well. So I'll take a question if you want to ask it now, or we can defer them for later in the day.
Here's one more question.
Okay.
Frank Tedisco with the GAO. Rob, you mentioned that you have separate decision-making bodies for investment policy and the rest of the plan. There's another point of view about that it's better to have it integrated so that the investment policy takes into account the characteristics of the liabilities of the plan, such as the length of the liabilities, and also in establishing the amount of risk that's taken on in the investment policy. Did you consider those aspects when you were deciding to separate those functions? And also, very specifically, who actually sets the investment return assumption? Is it the investment policy-making body or the other decision-making body?
Thank you. Good question. Actually, the board, the retirement board and the investment board were set in 1974, before a time that we were thinking about these issues in the same way. I understand your thoughts that it may seem a little disconnected, but the two organizations, at least in South Dakota, are just so tightly connected. My sitting on the investment board, the investment officer sitting on the retirement board, really meshes the two together, but at the same time divides the constraints. There, the effort of investments maintains just investments. The efforts of retirement board really just involves retirement. It means that we can have professionals on the investment board that wouldn't necessarily be participants on the retirement side, the independent trustees that are fiscally oriented, that get appointed to that committee, are not the same ones that you would have on the retirement board. So it was a different evolution for South Dakota. It's worked well for us because of the engagement of the two. Some of the issues you're talking about there, if we weren't so engaged together, it would be difficult. But because we are engaged, it's worked out well, and the process was set long before some of these issues were voiced. And it, over time, it's evolved to do the same things, maybe what you're talking about, but in a little different manner.
Can I just jump in there and answer the same question? Because it's sort of interesting. We have an integrated board, and they, in order to register, you must submit an investment policy and a funding policy, how you distribute your plan to distribute your excess earnings in advance, and that has to be registered with the superintendent. And you can change those annually based on demographics, but you have to, if you change them, you have to do the stress testing to show that you maintain the high level of security. And in our case, it's 97.5% probability of maintaining base benefits and 75% minimum probability of maintaining all benefits. And finally, our discount rate is completely determined by the market. It's not an actuarial assumption. So the first 2 years that this was brought in, we used a 4.5% discount rate, currently 4.75%, and that's based on a AA corporate bond rate. So there's no monkeying with the market. The market's the market.
Okay, well, thanks. Let's move now and let the private people come up now that we've publicly shared this information.